You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. This is Chris Wilson. I'm your host of Book Lovers Cafe, which is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the Sound and beyond. Today, I'm really excited to be introducing you to Gene Helfman, and he is an author, an animal behaviorist, and a conservation biologist. He comes to us in our area in the Pacific Northwest with a PhD in ecology from Cornell, and he is also a longtime faculty member at the University of Georgia. But now he's writing fiction, and that's a really exciting change. So welcome, Gene. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here. I really appreciate it.
So today we're going to be talking about his novel, Beyond the Human Realm. And from the title, you may not be quite sure about what this is all about. But it's talking about the life of Mackay, who is a male orca who was captured in the North Atlantic. And he was held in a marine park until things weren't really working out for him there. And he was rescued and then rehabilitated by the biologist. And we run into all kinds of other fascinating characters, including orcas. So, Gene, your life has been one of academic science. And then all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but then your life brought you to the Pacific Northwest, and I might say, you know, a nearby island close to us. Then you started writing fiction. So what led you to this change in your life?
Retirement?
Yes.
No, I was originally a fish behaviorist. I was hired at the University of Georgia to study fish behavior, mostly underwater, watching fishes. And fairly early in my career, I attended a fish conference up in Vancouver. And one of the evenings, the evening social was held at the Vancouver Aquarium. And they gave us free run of the place. And I got tired of shouting over the music and sitting in a, you know, standing in a smoke-filled room. And I wandered outside, found myself at the performance amphitheater there. Seemed like a nice, quiet place. Didn't realize. Just sat down. And then I realized I was watching a whale circling around a pond there. And I was fascinated. I'd never seen an orca. I knew what orcas were because I'm a biologist, but I knew absolutely nothing about them. And I watched this animal for a few minutes, and I realized that it wasn't swimming. It was pacing. It was basically a caged animal in a confined area. Something clicked. I found this very upsetting, but I realized I wanted to know more about orcas. So I started reading about them, and I started incorporating them in my classes, even though I was a fish person. You can maintain the interest of kids from Atlanta if you show them pictures of and videos of leaping orcas. And the germ of an idea of writing a novel appeared then, started to grow, and I obviously couldn't do that because I'd been hired to study fish, and the university wasn't going to tolerate my switching careers. But over a period of 25 or 30 years, I read more and more and started filling up notebooks with ideas about a possible novel. And then in 2007, I retired, moved to Lopez Island, sort of the Goldilocks zone for my wife and me. She's also a biologist. And I started to work seriously on the novel. In the meantime, the movies Free Willy had come out, and The Cove, which is this terrible story about a village in Japan, Taiji, where they capture, they have an annual whale roundup and kill many of them and capture many and send them off to the aquarium slave trade. And then Blackfish, the story of Tillicum, came out, I think, in 2013. And that was pretty much the germ of the novel, but it all kind of came together in, 2018 when Tahlequah, J-35, the female orca in the J-pod, who spent 17 days carrying her dead baby around on her tour of grief. And I'd had an idea of something about a dead baby whale in the novel I was thinking about writing, and it got so much media play and coverage around the world that I realized I had a good idea. I had an idea worth writing. So basically over about the next 2 years, settled here on Lopez Island, no longer having to study fish, although I don't
You haven't completely forgotten it. Yes.
Yeah. So yeah. So that's pretty much a brief history of how the novel appeared. I probably filled 10 notebooks, and when I finally got to writing, I threw them all away.
Mm-hmm. And just, well, I really want to commend you on weaving in the current knowledge and the stories that we have all heard about our orcas here in the Salish Sea. And, you know, it sounds like when you started out, they were still the killer whales. And so, you know, there's been a lot of transition and a lot of knowledge in the last 25 years. So let me tell you, I went back and forth as I was reading it from like, well, what is truth and what is fiction? And so let's introduce our listeners to a little bit of, a little bit from the book itself. Would you be willing to read to us?
Oh, I'd love to. And what I would like to do is read a chapter that is based 90% on a real event and real orca biology. I mean, interesting you say, yes, they were killer whales to me initially, and I probably subscribed to the theory this is something to be afraid of, but learned otherwise. So yeah, so let me read one brief chapter that introduces some important aspects of biology, the animals, and also the storyline in the novel. And I realize that people in this area are pretty sophisticated when it comes to orcas. And I apologize to anybody who's listening if I'm telling them something they already know. Just a little bit of orca biology that's relevant to the chapter. First off, we have two types of orcas in our waters primarily. I mean, there are a couple of others, but primarily we have two, what they call the residents and the transients, or bigs orcas. Regardless of type, these are formidable predators. Very, very impressive, top of the food chain everywhere in the world. The residents are fish eaters, like our southern resident killer whales in the Salish Sea. They feed primarily on salmon, and if given their choice, they feed primarily on Chinook or king salmon, which creates problems for them because Chinook salmon are basically, well, they're scarce, they're endangered, and they also tend to be contaminated with various pollutants and not good for the whales. But the residents are fish eaters, and the transients are big orcas. Feed on just about anything, but especially on marine mammals. So we're talking about seals and sea lions, whales, dolphins, sea otters, and apparently even an occasional moose if it finds itself swimming in the ocean. So in the chapter, it occurs in the book because it strengthens a growing relationship between two of the main characters, Dr. Rudy Laguna, who's an orca researcher, and his field assistant, Cassie Flanagan, who's a graduate student. And their relationship initially was mutually exploitative, would probably be an explanation. So that's part of the chapter helps their relationship grow. But secondly, it demonstrates to anybody less familiar with orcas than people around here just how intelligent these whales are. And then third, as I said, the story is based on an incident that actually occurred to someone I know. So in the chapter, Rudy and Cassie, and then Rudy's canine companion, Cheese, short for Cheese Whiz, go whale watching in Rudy's 10-foot-long Zodiac rubber inflatable boat. So what I'm hoping the reader can do is imagine that he or she is going along for the ride, hoping to find whales. They motored out of the harbor and headed south. The day was as perfect as could be expected for August, mostly sunny, maybe in the 60s, almost warm, a very light breeze, the water glassy. Rudy said, "Some whales were seen yesterday a couple miles south of here, so maybe they're hanging around, or at least we can hope." They continued slowly south, seeing nothing. Then Cheese, four legs on the bow as usual, gave his signal short bark that he always gave when he saw whales. He was looking off to the right. At first, Rudy didn't see anything, but then he saw it, a distinctive splash. It clearly wasn't a whale. It splashed again. Something was moving very fast across the surface, right to left, a couple hundred yards away. Then Rudy saw the whales a short distance behind, blowing and swimming fast. "Hold on," he shouted, and gunned the engine in the direction of the commotion. "We're in luck, Cassie. Rudy shouted over the engine noise. I think we've got some transient orcas chasing a harbor seal. It was pretty obvious what was happening. A harbor seal was swimming for its life, four orcas in hot pursuit. About 100 yards away, Rudy cut the engine and drifted. This was too good to be true. Or was, until the seal saw the boat. It made a sharp left turn and headed right for them. It didn't stop until it ran into the boat with a pronounced bump. Oh, phooey, I'm changing some of the grammar here for a family audience, Rudy shouted. He knew what was likely to happen. He grabbed an oar, stood up, and jabbed at the seal, trying to push it away. The seal dodged the oar and tried to leap into the boat. Rudy jabbed again. The seal bit down on the oar, pulling it out of Rudy's hands, and tossed it aside. With minimal effort, the seal leapt into the boat next to Rudy and snapped at him. Rudy scrambled towards the bow. Cassie didn't need to be told to move. Cheese barked once when the seal snapped at Rudy, then seemed to think better of it. And there they sat, Rudy, Cassie, and Cheese, crowded together in the bow, as far as possible from the seal in the stern, 9 feet away, next to the sputtering outboard motor. What's next, Rudy? Cassie said. Do you think they'll go away? Her voice showed interest, not concern. Maybe. Probably not. But I'm pretty sure we're okay. The whales are interested in the seal, not us. Or at least that's what all the books say. Your life vest's nice and tight, right? Just in case. Rudy was contemplating the unpleasant possibility of the whales, all twice the size of the boat, upending them to dislodge the seal like it was on an ice floe. But nothing happened. Instead, the whales moved slowly back and forth, about 50 feet behind the boat. The seal watched them. Then the whales started circling. Four large transients led by a male with a very tall dorsal fin. What do you think they're doing? Cassie asked. My guess, and it's only a guess, is they're assessing the situation and deciding on a course of action. And that might be? She asked. Well, Rudy hesitated. They clearly know the seal is in the boat, and they clearly want to eat it. I guess the main question is how to get it out of the boat and into the water. Hopefully just the seal, Cassie offered. Rudy wasn't really worried about being eaten along with the seal. Orcas, whether salmon-eating residents or seal-eating transients, just didn't eat people. It was one of the ongoing mysteries about these remarkable animals. Still, the prospect of being dumped in the cold water was less than enticing, and he wasn't sure how the whales would react to cheese. Did dogs have the same immunity as people? Cassie must have read his mind. I don't think we're in danger, but what about cheese? Rudy shrugged. Let's hope we don't find out. All four occupants of the boat swiveled around as the whales continued to circle. They were getting progressively closer to the boat, one following another, the big male still in the lead. Soon they were bumping up against the idling motor as they passed behind, the seal clearly tracking their movement. As the third orca bumped the motor, the seal leaned out and bit it on the dorsal fin. The orcas dove. Oh, phooey, Rudy whispered. He figured this was going to piss the whales off for real. Now what? Would this act of stupidity convince the whales to overturn them? Rudy was fascinated, his scientific curiosity, overcoming any fear. He'd never really spent much time watching transient orcas, having focused on their salmon-eating resident relatives. A whole new data entry, maybe even a publishable note. The whales remained out of sight. Have they gone away? Cassie asked. She sounded disappointed. I don't know, Rudy answered. But the whales hadn't gone away. About 30 seconds later, they appeared again, circling from a distance, blowing calmly, just like before. All four, one after another in a line, except now the big male was at the end instead of leading. Again, the whales tightened the circle, getting closer to the boat with each circuit. And again, they began bumping up against the motor, just like before. And, just like before, the seal leaned over to bite the third whale in the line. But as it did, the fourth whale, the male, leapt up, grabbed the seal's head, and yanked it into the water. What followed was as much a celebration as an attack, as the whales shredded the seal with shakes and tail splashes. At one point, the seal was catapulted high into the air, its limp body turning somersaults before landing. Soon, the water around the boat was stained red with seal blood. The last thing Rudy and Cassie saw was the large male orca with the seal in its mouth, swimming off, the other three whales swimming alongside, occasionally leaping from the water and landing sideways, throwing up huge fountains of spray. The three spectators watched silently, fascinated, as the whales disappeared. "I'll be damned," Rudy finally said aloud. "That was freaking fantastic." He turned to Cassie. She had a huge grin on her face. She put her arms around him and whispered in his ear, "Yes, freaking fantastic," she repeated. "Thank you, Rudy."
Okay, that's an amazing story, and even more amazing that it's true. That's something, you know, that I was really fascinated with and about this book, Gene, how you wove kind of really true biological facts about our environment with some things that I wasn't quite sure about. So let's talk about those. First of all, one question I had was about the traditional, well, no, let's back up a little bit, and because I remember we haven't really told our listeners that this book is told, at least half of it, from the point of view of J-Pod, from the orcas themselves, and more specifically, one that is joining J-Pod, Mackay. And we won't go into his backstory because, you know, that's interesting in itself. But you kind of think about how their society is and what they talk about and what they can do. And one of the things is a traditional greeting, something like, "How are the salmon?" Can you tell us about that?
"How fat are the salmon?"
"How fat are the salmon?"
"How fat are the salmon?" This touches on the aspect of the book that involves indigenous cultures. And while I was researching and thinking about writing the book, it became very clear to me that I couldn't develop a believable and accurate story of orca biology in the Pacific Northwest without including the importance of orcas in indigenous cultures on this coast and in many other coasts. Basically, wherever people co-occur with orcas, they are revered and are an important part of the culture, intertwined, as is so common in indigenous cultures. What I decided to do in developing the orca side of the story was treat them as another indigenous culture, as a tribe, with traditions, a matrilineal, maternally based or long maternal lineage of hierarchy, very strong social structure, with legends and explanations. That pivoted on the fact that we're dealing with an animal of incredible intelligence. Some people have speculated that, based on our measures of intelligence, that they are as smart or smarter than we are by the measures we commonly use. And certainly parts of their brain that are involved with social interaction, empathy, communication, those parts in the orca brain are larger than in ours. So it wasn't a leap for me to basically treat these organisms as social interacting, communicating with a complex language and a complex culture. And the greeting ceremony that you're mentioning, the first salmon ceremony, and the greeting that they use, their traditional greeting, "How fat are the salmon," plays into the historical importance of salmon in these animals' lives, going back hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years, and the fact that they have to wait for the salmon runs to appear before their summer feeding period will begin. So I basically took parts of a first salmon ceremony from a couple of different nations in the Pacific Northwest and had the orcas performing a similar tradition.
Mm-hmm. It really rings true. I think that was a really good idea. And then there was really interesting that they, from the fat in the salmon or how well the salmon runs are doing, they can think about future runs and then kind of limit the amount of children that they have. Where did you get this idea from?
I'm basically, again, because I am treating them as equal in every and any respect, and because they're a top predator that are limited by their food supply, or at least now are limited by their food supply, and historically they weren't, of course, and, you know, because the salmon runs were just so incredible. But now they can very easily outstrip their food resource. And so too many mouths to feed is not a good idea. And so this is speculation purely on my part. Although it is in part based on the fact that orcas are capable of reproducing at a much younger age than they actually begin to reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
They can reproduce at maybe age 11 or 12, but often within the groups they don't start reproducing for many years after. So obviously there's some sort of restraint going on. So it wasn't much of a leap to have that be a socially traditional restraint enforced by the elders, as is often the case, on the younger animals. And the problems that can arise if an animal goes off the reservation.
Mm-hmm. Well, not to make this sound like a purely scientific book, because it really is a fast-moving, it's almost a thriller. It's, you know, there's some chase scenes involved. There's some, you know, really exciting parts. There's romance. And so it's a very fun read, Gene, for our audience to know that. And tell us a little bit about, like, the superpowers that that the orcas have. And also it kind of mixes in with some communication with native characters in the story as well, where, you know, people have visions, and they also, can produce this sonic imagery where they really can see things and communicate that way. I loved that part.
What my background as a scientist, as a researcher, is that just about all of the biology that's in the book is taken from reference material or taken from books that have been written by orca researchers and their speculation as to what the orcas might be able to do. So, I didn't have to make it up. People who study orcas are in love with these animals and are, if not prone, easily led to speculate about what they might be capable to do, knowing what we know they can do. So the sound image projection idea that an orca could take the sound bouncing off an object, you know, they use their sonar to identify, and they identify at great detail size, shape, depth, internal characteristics, all of this comes back to them. And that they could then turn around and project that sound image to another orca to basically show them what they were seeing. This is an idea that's been put forth by Alexandra Morton in a couple of her books. She speculates that this can happen. I was happy to grab onto that. It hasn't been demonstrated, but it's a wonderful. It would be like our being able to see something and then turn around and project a hologram of what we saw based on our capabilities. But we can't do that. But they can project sound. We can't project light, but they can project sound. So that's the idea of a sound image. The thing you brought up about superpowers, the idea that an orca could blast a fish incapacitate mm-hmm. a fish by leveling a sonic blast at it, that's based on actual observations with dolphins, bottlenose dolphins, many videos of them working along the bottom and basically pointing their snout at a spot in the bottom, and all of a sudden a fish pops out limping, that can't swim away. And there's something, when the orcas are feeding, they'll vocalize a lot, and as they're approaching a fish, a prey item, their sonic clicks will speed up, and they have what they call the terminal buzz, which is very loud. It's sort of like, and which is beyond our hearing, but is a pulse of sound. So putting those together, I gave the orcas the ability to incapacitate prey with a sonic blast.
Oh, that's so exciting to know that there's scientific basis for that. There's another section that the orcas are able to recognize and identify a human enemy, And it made me think of what crows are capable of from the crow studies here at University of Washington.
Mars left wonderful study. Yes.
And so, of course, it's perfectly understandable that they would recognize and be able to follow a human that they wanted to keep track of. So that was really a good part, too. You know...
And there's pretty good evidence from the captivity world of them being able to identify the different trainers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's true. That's, of course. And there are Native American characters, Willow, and then a grandmother figure. That was really interesting the way you paralleled the grandmother from the Orca tribe and the Orca grandmother. And, you know, and we remember when, you know, the eldest female did die in the J-Pod. So did you consciously do that, you know, have the parallel grandmothers?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a stretch by any means. Mm-hmm. And there is very good evidence that within the pods, when the eldest female, when the matriarcher dies, a great deal of grieving occurs within the family. And interestingly, so male orcas, and unlike most mammal societies, orcas stay together with their the family unit over many generations, including the males. The males don't go off and find another group. That's in the residents. In the transients, they do it a little bit more. But in our resident animals, the males stay with the family right through adulthood. And if a matriarch or an older female dies, the probability of one of her sons also dying goes up dramatically.
Mm. Before we go, I just want to mention to our audience that all the profits from this book, Beyond the Human Realm, by Gene Helfman, are going to be donated to conservation efforts for whale conservation. And you can find different organizations by going to the Orca Network website. So if you just Google Orca Network, you'll be able to find that. And I'd also like to mention Jason Colby's book, Orca, Alexandra Morton's book, Listening to the Whales, or What Orcas Have Taught Us, and of course, Linda Mapes, Orcas, Shared Waters, Shared Homes. There's a lot of epigraphs that you have in this book that draw attention to those books. And thank you, Jean. You did an incredible job of taking all of these notebooks and making them into a fascinating and fun read for all of us. Thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Chris. The orcas made it easy for me.
Good storytelling. You're listening to Book Lovers Cafe. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Please join me next time to talk more about books and authors. And you can listen to past shows and other programs right from the podcast page on the website, kptg.org. I'd like to thank Nora Petridge, who's in the booth this afternoon, and Carl Allen, who's going to be editing this show. Thank you all to the volunteers and supporters who make this station possible. See you next time.